This evening we're going to start Nehemiah Perek Yud Aleph. So we are within striking distance of the end of Sefer Ezra Nehemiah. So that's an exciting development. So just to remind ourselves, Chapter 8, Perek Chet, the Tshuva Revolution. Chapter 9 is the Vidoy, is the Great Confession, which is a cross between Jewish history and that. That great confession of sin and recommitment. Chapter 10, Perek Yud, was what we call the Amana, was the self-binding oath, as it were, that the community accepted upon itself at that time. And we saw last week some of the interesting instances of commitments that they made, whether it was in regard to, as we might expect, intermarriage and addressing that issue, which is, of course, a common motif in Ezra Nehemiah, whether it may be in terms of Shabbat, whether it's in terms of Shemitah, both Shemitah, right, we saw Shemitah both in terms of the agricultural piece as well as the loan piece, and then the Maaser and all the upkeep that was necessary for the Beit HaMikdash. So that's what we had discussed. That's what we discussed over the last three chapters. So Ruth, we just quickly summarize the previous three chapters just to set the stage for this evening. So just once more to make sure we're on the same page. We saw Tshuva Revolution led by Ezra Nehemiah. We saw the Great Confession. We saw the Amanah, the oath that they accepted. And they had fully recommitted themselves to the Torah generally, but to a number of commitments and principles in particular. So today we start with something interesting. And then we're going to get to another long list. And chapter 12 as well. You bet is going to be another long list. But there are other pieces that are really very interesting and worth spending more extensive time on examining more closely than some of those longer lists. So, Nehemiah Perek Yud Aleph begins as follows, Vayeshavu Sarei Ha'am B'Yerushalayim. So having just committed themselves to observe this oath, so the officers of the nation dwelled or settled or remained in Yerushalayim. Ushaar ha'am hi pilu goralot. The remnant, the rest of the nation, drew lots. Lahavi echad min ha'asara, to bring one of ten. Lashevet b'Yerushalayim ir ha'kodesh, to dwell in Yerushalayim, the holy city. V'tisha hayadot be'arim, and the other nine, literally hands or portions of the community, would live in the cities. Vayivarchu ha'am pasuk bet, the nation blessed l'chol ha'anashim hamitna devim lashevet b'Yerushalayim. All the people who had volunteered themselves to dwell, to settle in Yerushalayim. So let's just think about what's happening here for a second.
So we're one-tenth to dwell, but they volunteered?
Yeah, they volunteered.
So if you only volunteer, the first one-tenth get to go to Jerusalem.
Whichever one-tenth volunteered dwelled in Yerushalayim. So this is essentially Maaser, which we talked about in the previous parak toward the end. Right? You take one-tenth of your produce and you designate it, etc. Is that here we're not talking about tithes of your produce. We're talking about humans. We're talking about Jews. We're talking about the community. One-tenth of the community dedicated themselves, as it were, personally as tithes to the community, dedicating themselves, volunteering to settle in Yerushalayim. Why would this be necessary? Is this for the sake of holiness? Is this to feel a connection to the holy city? Perhaps. But there is also a more basic necessity that we've already encountered throughout the book of Nehemiah, which is, we know, the Jewish community had fought tooth and nail to build that wall, to defend themselves, to build a protective layer around the city of Yerushalayim. And we know that their enemies were quite unhappy with that. We remember as well that the overwhelming majority of people who had returned had come back to their original cities. Right? And so what you have here is a situation in which Yerushalayim has been secured, and yet the situation presumably remains quite tenuous. Nehemiah had made tremendous strides in strengthening the fortifications of the city, and yet clearly they weren't quite there at this point. And so there's a need to go ahead and to permanently fortify the city. And you need residents to do that, to establish a foothold. You really need someone to live there. So they asked for volunteers. Who wants to live in Yerushalayim? Would you take them up on that? Right? I don't know. Did they get free housing? I don't know. Was there a stipend? You know, nowadays, you know, tax credit. Exactly, right? To make Aliyah, all of that. Who knows? But that's essentially what happened. It's a remarkable kind of thing. So Nehemiah, although it does not say explicitly Nehemiah is sort of organizing all of this or orchestrating this movement, you have to imagine that he's the author of the book. He's been actively involved behind the scenes and in front of the scenes as well, front and center really, in terms of organizing all of the protective measures and taking behalf of the holy city. Presumably he continues to be involved, although it's not 100% explicit here. But the human tithes. The tithes of March, right?
Did they have trouble getting the 10%?
Did they have trouble? It looks good, right?
They have it, yes.
Looks like it was a home run. Can you imagine? I mean, this is really interesting.
It seems like the other cities were tied too. They were allocated. You know, they went to other cities.
That's true, but it does not seem to have been a sacrifice. The sacrifice was making Aliyah. That was a huge sacrifice in of itself. And that, by the way, may explain why this community, this group, was more receptive to this idea, because this was a self-sacrificial community. And they had given everything up in Babylon to come to an uncertain future to return to the land of Israel. It's utterly devastated. So they've already given up so much. So maybe it's a self-selecting population that then is willing to live in Yerushalayim at a time when it's clearly abandoned and ill-suited to defend. But I just want to answer the question, which I haven't gotten to. I think the difference is all the other cities were the same, where their family had come from. Some 50 years ago, their lives were there. So they were returning to their hometowns. That's a very different kind of thing. Here, they're abandoning all the families, everyone, Kohanim, Levim, Yisraelim, everyone, they were all returning to their original locations, their original cities.
So most people came back to Jerusalem living there beforehand?
Hmm?
I've got to take dinner home because that's not true. I'm going to come back.
Okay, no problem.
You're saying that
I got it.
They were all there before, or their families were there previously?
They were all there before.
Before they were exiled?
Went back to their locales.
I guess they're also, part of being there, part of volunteering, is also that they'd have to defend it if it came to that, right?
Absolutely. So
that was going to be part of the deal. Yes, you would volunteer, but knowing that you're going to defend it.
Yeah. Well said. That's probably right. Imagine so.
They're pretty much pretty dedicated people to do that.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep. Okay.
Oh, I see. Now they're going to start talking about the VM and...
That's right. No more lists. Plenty of those in Ezra Nehemiah. So now it tells us who dwelled in Yerushalayim. Ve'ela Roshei Hamdina sheyashvu b'Yerushalayim. So these are the leaders. Uve'arei Yehuda yashvu ish b'achuzato b'areihem Yisrael hakohanim v'halviim v'hanetinim uvnei avdei shlomo. The same groups, the same characters that we've seen throughout. Uve'Yerushalayim yashvu. In Yerushalayim, the following people dwelled: mibnei Yehuda, mibnei Binyamin. Right. So those are the two southern tribes. The two southern tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin, those were the ones that had survived. Mibnei Yehuda, and it gives you the list. We don't have to read every single instance, but then it gives you, and by the way, it says explicitly that they were warriors. In Pasuk Vav, it says, Kol b'nei Peretz hayishum Yerushalayim, 468. So, for example, from the family of Peretz that had dwelled in Yerushalayim, she had 468 people. Anshei Chaya, warriors. Anshei Chaya. So explicitly lends to your point that they had to be equipped. Then it gives you Bnei Binyamin, and it gives you a number of names, and then in Pasuk Chet you have the number 928. And then you have some of the leadership in Pasuk Tet, the Yoel ben Zichri, a name we're not really familiar with to this point. He was the appointed above them, the Huda ben Hasanua al Ha'ir Mishneh. He was the viceroy, the second in command. Then in Pasuk Yud you have after the description of Yehuda and Binyamin, you have Mina Kohanim, who are living in Yerushalayim, Yedaya, more names, Siraya, Ben Mishul, etc., etc. One of those is in the end of Pasuk Yud Aleph, the end of verse 11, Nigid Beit HaElokim. So he's somehow in charge. He's the appointed one over the Beit HaMikdash. Remember, Beit HaMikdash had been rebuilt, so for them to then give up Yerushalayim would have been obviously a complete disaster. But it's just, imagine the scenario and think about the contrast to the time of Shlomo. Time of Shlomo, they build the Beit HaMikdash, that was the centerpiece, and was built around a city that was already teeming with monarch Ir David, right, which was populated in its own right, and then the city more generally, and then the holy building, the Beit HaMikdash, was built as the locus of a community that had already existed in substantial numbers and was deeply anchored there. Here it's quite the opposite. They barely scratched and pulled things together in order to somehow manage to rebuild the temple, to build the second Beit HaMikdash, but they did not really have a core. So it's not just that Yerushalayim couldn't be abandoned, etc. The Beit HaMikdash was there. And yet they didn't really have anyone to live in the city. Can you imagine? And think about the contrast to the time of Shlomo. So when we talk about the Beit HaMikdash no longer being the locus for the community in that same way, it's evident just from the sheer population, from right, the notion of having hundreds of thousands or something, you know, that's obviously an exaggeration, but having thousands upon thousands of people screaming toward the Beit HaMikdash for Aliyah LeRegel, these kinds of things. I mean, those days are long gone. We don't have a community like that. Certainly, you know, a community coming into Yerushalayim, which is already a populated city, and entering its marketplaces, the shuk, and it's, you know, teeming with people. It's not like that anymore. It's just such a different model. And so it stands to reason that Yerushalayim develops very differently, and that Judaism develops very differently than it had, because there really was not a locus of a community around the Beit HaMikdash to build out the ritual as the centerpiece of the Jewish community. We're much, again, 90% of the community is in exile. And of the 10%, you have, again, another 90%. That's, you know, this is obviously an oversimplistic sort of guesstimate, but we're talking about 99% of the Jewish people living outside of Yerushalayim. We're talking about a much diminished community after the Roman, the Babylonian persecution, the Babylonian destruction of the temple, and the exile, and the diaspora, and the loss of the 10 tribes. It's a totally different ballgame. It just gives us a sense as to what we're struggling with and why this really is the end of Nivuah. It really is. It's Nivuah to the extent that it's associated with the Beit HaMikdash, etc., or the Beit HaMikdash is the locus of Jewish life and the charismatic leader of the Kohen, etc. It's a very different time in history. Then you have the Levim and Tevav. We don't have to read all the names from the list. I just realized, I apologize, that I accidentally cut off a little bit of the list. You'll see that on the next page, on page 2. Apologize for that. Be that as it may, you have the list. You have the Kohanim, you have the Levim, and there are different roles that they play. Again, as we've seen throughout, the ones that are in charge of the gates, the ones that are in charge of the prayers, or the Sigri in the Beit HaMikdash. And then it gives you in Pasuk Chaf in 20, Sha'ar Yisrael, HaKohanim, Alvim, Chol HaRei, Yehuda, Shvenachlat. Now we transition from Yerushalayim to the larger community, and then you have a list of all the different leadership and members of the community in all these different locations. We don't need to read every single place. Well, these are all the communities that they live in, and that takes us from Chaf Aleph, essentially, all the way through Lamed Vav, which is the end of the Perek. So essentially what we have in chapter 11 is really a move to settle Yerushalayim permanently, and then the remainder of the Perek is really just an outline of the families that live first in Yerushalayim, whole thing. Right. In other words, 34 out of the 36 psukim in this parak are simply lists of families, beginning with Yerushalayim. That's part one. That takes us through Pasuk Yud Tet, and then from Chaf to Lamed Vav, you have settling of the wider Jewish community at that time. Zehu. I think that's really it. Did I have this upstairs? All right. Okay. So that's piece one. And that's a quick way to get through a parak in Sefer Nechanim. Parak kind of makes that easier. You know, they used to say, you know, if you want to make a siyum, start from the end. So we started from the beginning, but okay. Good. That takes us to Parak Yud Bet, and again, we have more lists. Except this list goes back in history. So this is a record from an earlier time in which in which you had an aliyah. Remember, at the very beginning of Sefer Ezra, we saw the aliyah of Zerubbabel. Before Ezra and Nehemiah even came to the land of Israel, we already saw that the first six chapters of Sefer Ezra are Zerubbabel, and that's one time in history. Perek Zayin through Yud of Ezra are the Aliyah of Ezra, that's a later period, and then you come to Nehemiah beginning at the very beginning, at the very opening of Sefer Nehemiah. Fine. So Nehemiah, Perek Yudbet, records the Aliyah from the Olim, those who made Aliyah, from an earlier stage in history, namely the period of Zerubbabel, which took place, as recorded, the beginning in the earlier section of Sefer Ezra. So it says, "Ve'ela kohanim v'aliyah she'alum Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel v'Yeshua," who were the leaders at that time, the kohanim, the levim, who came up, and then you have, again, a long list, right? So you can read it very quickly. Suraya, Yirmiyah, Ezra, familiar names, but again, we've seen these before and yet said that they're not necessarily the same ones that we think of when we think of these names. Amariah, Maluch, Hatush is very similar to earlier lists. Shechaniah, Rechum, Remot, Ido, Gintoy, Aviyah, and so on and so forth. Pasuk Chet comes to the Levian. Again, like we've seen throughout the Sefer. Levian, Yeshua, Binoi, Kadmiel, Sherev, Yayu, Damatanya, Alhudos, which is a very different kind of name, almost Greek sounding. And then you have further list of all of these individuals, and it goes for quite some time. At the end of Pasuk Chafbet 22, the next page, you have the Levim. Halevim b'meil yashiv yoyadav yochanan v'yaduak tuvim rashi avot v'akhanim al-machut daryavish ha-parsi. So they were recorded during the kingdom of Darius, the Persian king, the Persian emperor. They were recorded at that time, and you have further lists for some time, and that takes us through Pasuk Chavav 26. Eva bimei Yoyakim ben Yeshua ben Yotzadak. Those were the ones who came, who ascended during the time of Yeshua. Uvimei Nechemiah HaTechav Yezra Kohen HaSofer. This is a sort of a kaleidoscope or pericope of all of those names. Okay. Now we come to story time again. Chav Zayin, Chanukat Chomat Yerushalayim, and with the dedication of the wall of Yerushalayim at that time, Bikshu et Halvim Mikol Mikomotam. They sought out the Levites from all their places, LaHavyam Yerushalayim, to bring them to Yerushalayim. LaAsur B'Chanukah V'Simcha V'Tadot U'Bshir Mitzaltayim Nivalim U'Vchinorot. So what were they going to do? They were going to celebrate Chanukah, right? LaAsur Chanukah. Is that what they were doing? They're celebrating Chanukah. Hard to imagine they were celebrating Chanukah, because Chanukah, my friends, did not yet happen. So that's clear. Chanukah, of course, we know, originally means, the literal translation is, a dedication. So Chanukat HaMishkan was the dedication of the Mishkan, as we find it already in Chumash. So this is the dedication of the walls of Yerushalayim. So it seems that Nehemiah is perhaps going back somewhat in time here, which is interesting, but he's returning us to the time when they completed the construction of the walls of Yerushalayim, which, as we saw earlier, was a cause for tremendous simcha for the community at that time, without any question at all. And so what happens? Uvachanukat Chomat Yerushalayim, and upon the dedication of the walls of Yerushalayim, Bikshu Talviyim Mikomotam LaVyam Yerushalayim. They sought out the Levites from all their places to come to Yerushalayim. In other words, they made a big party that all the musicians, the Levites, joined for this mass gathering, for this great celebration. LaAsot Chanukah, to make this dedication, V'Simcha UvTodot V'Shir, and with thanksgiving and with song. Todot might, right, literally means thanksgiving, but also might be an allusion to a korban, korban toda, mitzil tayim, nivalim uchinorot. We know that halachically they would offer, when they extended the sanctity of Yerushalayim, there was a whole process which is based in part on this story. One of the things that they would do is they would offer a korban toda, sacrifices of thanksgiving. And they use all the same traditional instruments that you find in Tehillim and elsewhere in Tanakh. Chavchet. ויעשו בני המשור ורימו, מן הכיכר סביבו ירושלים, מן חצרים לתופתי, ומביר הגוגו, מסתות גבע ועזמה, וכי חצרים בנו להם המשורים סביבו ירושלים. In other words, the Levites had stuck together, and they built Levi towns, and the Gemara has a case. What happens if you have an Ir Shekula Kohen? You have a city that's entirely inhabited by priests, like Kohanim. What's the halacha for Bechad Kohanim, who gets you know, who gets the aliyot, how do you do all of that? How do you figure all those things out? Ir Shekula Kor. So these were Arim Shekulam, or almost Kulam Levi'im. These were Levite towns that the Levi'im had inhabited at this time in history. And so this is the idea that we have.
So when they went into exile, did they do the same thing?
It's a great question. We think that the Kohanim and Levi'im, at least in the immediate aftermath of their exile, remained bound together to some degree, identified as a group in an ongoing fashion, even as they were no longer needed for the Avodah and the Beis HaMikdash. Obviously, they were often Babel. In fact, there's reason to think there may have even been tensions between the Kohanim and Levi'im at that time. But it's shrouded in some mystery. We don't know for sure, but it seems that at least for a temporary amount of time, they continued to self-identify in that way. Okay. Pasuk Lamed Vayitaru HaKohanim VaHalviim. The Kohanim and Leviim purify themselves, or became purified, right? Same thing. Vayitaru Ta'am. They purified the nation. V'etashiarim Yetachuma. The gates of Yerushalayim, the wall of Yerushalayim. V'a'alels Etzarei Yehuda Me'al Lachomas. And Nehemiah says, and I brought up the princes of Yehuda above the wall, at the top of the wall. V'amidashti todo kidolo v'taluchot layamin mi'al lachoma. So he sets up these groups, these large walking groups that were going to give thanks. L'shar hashpot. They walk to Shar hashpot, which you still have in Yerushalayim nowadays. And then you have lists of people who followed them in Lamed Bet 32. V'yelech achareihem, who walked after them, these people, Hoshaya, Chatzisar Yehuda, half the officers of Judah, Azariah, Ezra, Mishulam, Yehuda, Binyamin, Shemaya, Yirmiyah. And you have more lists of people who were involved in this in Lamed Hay and Lamed Vav. They were using, says the Pasuk, at the conclusion of Pasuk Lamed Vav, Bichle Shir David, 36, Isha Elokim. They were utilizing, they were playing the instruments of David, the man of God, the Ezra Sefer Lifnehem. So they were using the songs and the music of David HaMelech, presumably from Tehillim, and you had Ezra was walking before them, Lifnehem, as part of this great procession of the dedication of the walls of Yerushalayim, the wall of Yerushalayim. And again, in the Gemara, in Masechet Shavuot, this is taken as actually an extension of the sanctity of Yerushalayim, which is a quite interesting kind of phenomenon. This is considered to be a sort of, it's not just that they were dedicating the wall, but this is actually an expansion of the Kedushat HaMakom, of the sanctity of the place, that halachically is very interesting in contemporary topic as well, that you can actually extend the Kedushah of Yerushalayim. This is very relevant nowadays because, of course, Yerushalayim is well extended beyond the original parameters of the old city. And there are halachot that are relevant to the Kedushah of Yerushalayim. So the question becomes, well, what areas of the modern day city of Yerushalayim are invested with the halachic status of Yerushalayim? I'll give you an example. Here was a modern day dispute that broke out, I don't know, maybe relatively modern day, maybe 100 years ago, or even a little bit less. What is the status of the extended areas of Yerushalayim with regard to the reading of the Megillah? Reading of the Megillah, very relevant this week. Why? Purim's coming right up. So we know that the halacha is that any city that had a wall from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun reads the Megillah till today, reads the Megillah on the 15th rather than the 14th day of the month of Adar. That's the halacha. That's the halacha that we know. So, right, just like Shushan, modeled after Shushan. In Shushan, they celebrated the holiday of Purim, not on the 14th, like the rest of the cities, rather, on the 15th day of the month of Adar. So here is the question that arose among the poskim. What is the status of the rest of the city of Yerushalayim, the modern city of Yerushalayim, vis-a-vis Kriyat Megillah? And there's a dispute about this issue. A minority opinion held that that is not the city of Yerushalayim. Did that area of Yerushalayim, did all the neighborhoods, even Yamin Moshe, never mind a Talpiot or wherever, what have you. Right? Were those neighborhoods in the city of Jerusalem, did they have a wall at the time of Yehoshua ben Nun?
No.
Nonsense. Obviously not. So perhaps one should argue that those areas are not part of the biblical city of Yerushalayim. They did not have a wall at the time of Yehoshua ben Nun. And you should read the Megillah on the 14th, just like we do here in Lower Merion or wherever it may be. Maybe that should be the halakha. Others said no, and the majority of you became that actually, although it's true that that area did not have a wall at the time of Yehoshua ben Nun, still it is considered to be, it is an extension of that same city. There's continuous residence. There are, you know, it's the same, you get taxed by the same city. It's the same municipality. All indications are it's the same city. And after all, if the modern day Shushan, right, if a Jew is to be living in that area, mm-hmm. would you say that if there was a new, the wall doesn't exist, it's a wall that existed at the time of Yehoshua ben Nun. You know, Yerushalayim did not have a wall around it, they would still continue to read. So it's not that it has to have a wall nowadays, it depends on Yehoshua ben Nun. And then Mimela, once you don't have a wall, naturally you're gonna extend the area. So the majority view is that the wider area of Yerushalayim has the status of Yerushalayim, and therefore they read in the 15, that's the common practice nowadays, although there are some neighborhoods that are on the immediate outskirts of Yerushalayim, and there remains a question as to whether they're considered part of Yerushalayim or not. So halach in the Gemara, it has to be... There are different practices in Maliyat Yumim. Mivaseret is an interesting question. Mivaseret is an interesting question. Different practices as well. Some people have the practice to read in two places, to be Yotze the Safik. Some people just like to celebrate two days of Purim. You have that as well. Why not? So you have that. You have that too. That's already a second level question. But the larger question as to the possibility of extending the status of Yerushalayim has all sorts of halachic ramifications, whether it be with regard to the reading of the Megillah or other issues as well, in terms of the halachot of what is invested with that sanctity. There are different minhagim that have developed over the years. Minhagim of Yerushalayim. So what does that mean, Yerushalayim? How do we define Yerushalayim? Other halachos as well. So this whole section, this whole process is taken by the Gemara is not just a dedication of the wall, but an expansion of the halachic parameters of the city of Yerushalayim. And so in that sense, there's a celebration because we're actually adding Kiddushah. Right? In other words, we're creating a halakhic and spiritual, almost metaphysical status which did not previously exist. And that requires a certain kind of input of a Sanhedrin, the Gemara talks about, perhaps, and a certain ritual that is required to take place for that to take effect, the leadership has to weigh in, etc. But there's also a celebration that must take place in the wake of such an expansion. And so that's how the rabbis really understand this event and this process in this broader kind of way.
Why is there an expansion?
Well, when they built when they built that wall, it was pretty clear that was an expanded area of Yerushalayim. And there's even the walls, not in this description, you don't see that, but when you go back to the original parameters of the walls that Nehemiah built, those were clearly wider than the original walls of the old city. So it's on the basis of Perek Dalet, basically. Okay. So they had the Korbanot Todah and they had the two walking groups, as it were. So Lamed Chet, V'atodah Shinit Halechet L'mol V'ani Achareha. So there was another group that was walking to give thanksgiving. They were walking corresponding to or opposite the other group. And I was together with it. V'chatiya Mi'al Allah Choma. And half the nation was above the wall. Mi'al L'migdal Tanurim, above the tower of the ovens. V'ani Choma Rechava. And it gives you sort of the walking group, as it were, the directions for this entire procession, and they stand here and they stand there, and ultimately pasuk mem 40 ta'amudna shtei atzadot b'veit Elokim, the two groups, which the rabbis understand also is accompanied by the two sacrifices, really stood in the house of God. Va'ani v'chatzi askanim mimi, I Nehemiah, and half of the officers of the community were together with me. These, by the way, the same skanim that he often told off. He told them off. regularly earlier. He said, what are you doing not taking care of the poverty stricken in your community? What are you doing not rebuilding the wall properly and taking care of the holy city of Yerushalayim? But I have to leave my work in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar just to come here to take care of things, etc. So the emperor, not Nebuchadnezzar. So this is essentially, this is the same skanim that are with him, ironically. Names. It's so interesting. It's so typical for the Persian period. I mean, you have that here, you have that in the Book of Esther, you have just these extremely regimented and extensive documentation of every single thing that happens. It's very typical of these period.
Documented all these names?
Yeah. And you know what? It makes it more historical. It's very interesting. I mean, I don't know if maybe he thought of it, and they probably thought of it in the same way, that there will come a time when they will want to determine whether or not these records are truly accurate. What are we going to do? What are we going to require? We're going to require some sort of official, specific, precise set of details. Because you know what? If it's just too generic, no one's going to believe it. We all know that history that's compelling, and from a scholarly perspective, is that has details. Even a novel, if you want to write a good novel, you don't write generically. You give very specific descriptions. And it allows the reader to really feel as if he or she is there. We know that that's how good writing is done.
So, were these people buried on the Mount of Olives? Was
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know the history. There's certainly nothing, to the best of my knowledge, that's detailed here. The history of Har HaZeitim is an interesting question, but one that I'm not overly familiar with. So we can do some research, though. I'll make you a deal. Belina, there, you do some research, I'll do some research, and we can compare notes. Let's see what we can find out. Does that sound like a good deal? Okay, Har HaZeitim.
Email
him. Okay. I have to make a note then. I'm curious. All right. So remind me when we're done, please, to grab my phone and make a note to... I don't have time to extensive research, but I'm curious to find out the history. But I don't know if that has anything to do with us.
He's buried in...
So we have to go to Har HaZeitim and see if we can find an ancient grave...
With these names.
Gravestone with these names. That's it. Right? But that's how real history is written. So, yeah. That I don't know if we're going to be able to... To locate. Okay, so you have this little group, and they start offering sacrifices in verse 43, Pesuk Mem Gimel. Vayizbechu vayomahu zvachim gedolim vayismachu. They sacrifice great sacrifices. They rejoice. Ki ha'elokim, and this is also so classic of Nehemiah, very typical. Ki ha'elokim simcham simcha gedola, because God gave them great rejoicing. Remember the question of the tension between mourning and rejoicing has been a motif throughout. We saw at the end of chapter 3 of Ezra, so this is all the way back when they had first completed the second temple, we said that the majority of people, or many of the people, were singing, but those who had seen the first temple began to cry. And while it's not 100% clear in the Psukim there, we see very clearly in the book of Haggai, which we learned together, that the reason for the crying is simply because the second Beit HaMikdash did not begin to compare to the glory of the first, which fits into everything that we've been discussing. And so you have the pairing of joy and mourning. More recently, in the book of Nehemiah, during the period of the Tshuva Revolution, so the community desires to mourn, to cry. And the community is told by the leadership, by Ezra and the others, and says, no, today is, they don't say Rosh Hashanah, but today is a holiday. Today is a festival. You need to rejoice today. So what do? They listen, right? And that's where it says that they give Mishlach Manot and all of that. And so they were rejoicing. But then afterward, they started to cry again. And that was Perek Tet. So the emotional swings of a community that on the one hand has rebuilt, has returned, has almost miraculously rebuilt the temple, rededicated themselves to the covenant, and yet finds themselves in physically almost dire straits at points in the story, and learns of their of the extent of their ignorance, feels guilt-ridden over intermarriage and their various shortcomings, the emotional tensions of this community, which is an existentially angst-ridden community. Existentially, I mean literally, their existence is not guaranteed on the basis of any natural means that we could identify. This is the survival of this community is far from guaranteed, much like the early kibbutzim and the early olim who come to Israel in the earlier parts of the 20th century. I mean, there are no guarantees for these communities. And I remember reading, there's a classic letter of Rav Kook, one of my favorite. It's written to the founder of the Bezalel School of Art. Bezalel School of Art was founded by a secular individual by the name of Boris Schatz, who in 1906, I want to say, I believe, founded the Bezalel School of Art. You can fact check me on that. That's my memory offhand. And he writes a letter to Rav Kook about the halachic parameters of this new school that he wants to open. And there's a very interesting letter that Rav Kook writes to him. But Boris Schatz writes in this letter, it seems, and Rav Kook is responding to this, that some are criticizing him and they say, what are you doing? Here we are, struggling to make ends meet. And we've got farmers who are barely putting bread, you know, whatever they're putting on their tables. And what are you going to do? You're going to start a cultural institution. I mean, that's very lovely for New York City, for London, for Paris, you name it. Are you going to do that in this not even country? You're going to do that? And we're struggling so mightily. So Rav Kook feels the need to push back against that criticism. He says, without a creative soul, there's no opportunity for a true renaissance. If you think that we're going to rebuild the land of Israel, including its neshama, by just scraping by and just rolling up our sleeves and working by the sweat of our brow, and that's it, we're never going to develop the cultural riches, the soulful experience that we're looking to generate through this process. So, you know, this notion of the community being in a very difficult spot is highly contemporary as well. It's very reminiscent of Zionist history as well. So these emotions and being torn in different directions at a time of existential angst is very familiar to us and is very much the story of this community. So you have that now. Again, the swing, and he's giving us another emotional swing. We were just mourning a parak or two ago, and now we're describing a celebration. Happened previously, but still the juxtaposition in the story, I think, is very telling about the swings of emotion that the community is experiencing at this time. So God made them rejoice. The women, the children, everyone was celebrating. The joy of Yerushalayim was heard from a distance. What did they do? They also appointed people over certain chambers, certain responsibilities. For treasuries, for the truma, for the reshid, for the bikurim that were brought to the Beit Hamikdash, presumably for the master that was brought to the Beit Hamikdash, the tithes, lechnos b'hem l'sneha arim in ha'otah Torah, to bring them into the field according to the enumeration, in other words, the obligations that the Torah had laid out and that the community had accepted in the previous chapters as well, two prakim ago in Perek Yud. They'd accept the Kohanim v'Leviim. Ki simchat Yehuda l'Kohanim v'Leviim omdim. Right, the simcha, the joy again, was present for the community at that time. By Yishmerush Mishmer Elokehem Mishmer HaTorah, they observe the observance of their God and that of the purity of HaMishorim, HaShorim, the singers, the gates people, Kimitzvat David Shlomo Vino. That's an unusual phrase. How do they translate that here? They say it's both. Right, you see what they say? In the English translation here that we have is according to the commandments of David and of Solomon his son on the next page, for verse 45. Right. So in other words, what are we describing here? You can actually see the next verse also, it brings this home. So I'm now in 46 in Memvav. Ki vimei David ve'asaf mikedem, because in the days of David and Asaf, was one of the lead Kohanim at that time, they had put in place Roshei HaMeshorerim v'shir tihila v'hodot le'elokim. They had this singing and praise had been given to God. So again, this is, to me, this is exactly this dichotomy. What are they doing? They're once again recommitting themselves. They're restoring the legacy of David and that of Shlomo, right? They are collecting the tithes. They have people living in Yerushalayim. They have a group that is committed to the upkeep of the Beit HaMikdash, the halachic upkeep, to ensure the entire Jewish community is giving the Truma, giving the Maser, bringing the Bikurim to the Beit HaMikdash, and they put back into place, they reinstitute the decrees, the takanot of David and Shlomo. They sing the songs of David and Asaph, the songs of the Tehillim. So here you have a community that, again, and they're celebrating in this way. But I think this is exactly the tension, this is the irony. They're not creating a new tradition, they're trying to recreate, or they only have really the traditions, not a bad tradition, mind you. But that's what they have, the traditions of David and Shlomo. So they're not reinstituting anything. The only way for them to attempt to recover the glory of the Beit HaMikdash is to attempt to do what? Is for in their simcha to connect back to the experiences that they had when they were still living under David and Shlomo. In other words, the glory years. That's not too bad. They know the basic structures that were in place for quite some time. Whether it was precise or not, who knows. They had the Tehillim, they had the songs, they presumably knew which instruments. You know, Tehillim has as many instructions that we don't necessarily understand nowadays. You'll say, L'amatzeach al hashminit. What does that mean? For the conductor upon the eighth. What is that? That's an instrument that's meant to be played accompanying this song. We don't use, nowadays we say Tehillim typically. Maybe we sing it as a song, but we rarely have it accompanied by a musical instrument. I mean, you have that with modern singers, but ritually we don't sing it in that way. But that's exactly how David HaMelech had composed, and the authors of Tehillim had composed these songs, L'manatzeach al shminit, and so on and so forth, Shviit, etc. So I think again this captures beautifully the irony. Their achievement is miraculous, their simcha is astounding, and yet in order to move forward, in order to be able to celebrate, what do they need to do? They need to return to anchor themselves in the traditions of a community that had existed so many years before. Only by reconnecting with the legacy of David, Shlomo, Asaph, etc., are they able to recapture some of the remaining sparks of the time that was really by God. And that's really what we have. Mem Zayin, v'chol Yisrael b'mei Zerubbabel v'mei Nechemiah, and all of the Jewish community in the time of Zerubbabel and the time of Nechemiah, neotanim minayot mishorim v'asharim v'ryom v'yomel. You know what? And this is again back in the time of Zerubbabel, but also forward in the time of Nechemiah. You know what? They kept it properly. They gave the portions that were necessary to support the Levim and the Beit HaMikdash, Shorim and the Mishorim, Umakdishim Lalvim. They sanctified that which needed to be given to the Levim. Lalvim Makdishim Levnei Aharon, and Levim would take their portion that they were required to then designate for the Kohanim, and they would separate that as well, and so they were able to successfully observe these mitzvot. So we see one of the major themes in Perek Yud and Perek Yud Bet, in these final chapters of Nehemiah, is this notion of the ma'aser, of the day-to-day, and we're only finding out now that the ma'aser had already been instituted back at the time of Zerubbabel, which is very interesting. It was not mentioned earlier, even though Zerubbabel is at the beginning of the Sefer. That's the first six chapters of Sefer, so we only learn about that now. So I think what we see here is that despite the chronological mismatch, as it were, of part of what's going on here, is, I think, two things. Number one, the notion that ma'aser is a theme of the end of the book of Nehemiah. Maser in multiple senses of the term, meaning maser in the traditional sense of giving the tithes to the Beit HaMikdash, but of course, as we saw at the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph, right? The human maser, where you take a tenth, take a tithe of the Jewish people to settle in and to protect and care for properly the city of Yerushalayim, right? Not only that, you had the maser, but you also had the, well, not the machzir ha-shekel, not the half-shekel, but you had the shlishit ha-shekel, however you understood that. And so it was a little bit unusual, but the third of the shekel, which the community in Perek Yud had recommitted themselves to, or committed themselves to donate donating to the Beit HaMikdash. That was something they accepted as well. The sense of constancy, the sense of, you know, it's one thing to undergo the major undertakings that are necessary in order to rebuild. That's one crucial step. With all the work that takes and with all the achievement that Nehemiah had accomplished and had spearheaded at that time, that's not enough. Because we require what we call the Tzmidim Kisidran Musafim Kelchatam. We need the day in, day out in order to sustain the day in, day out functioning of the Beit HaMikdash, to ensure that it continued to function in perpetuity, at least for a long period of time. There were certain structures that needed to be put in place about the Truma, about the Maaser. You couldn't have Kohanim and Levim working in the Beit HaMikdash unless they were receiving the salary that had sustained them previously, and that had to come from taxes. So you needed a system. You needed the community to buy in, to recommit themselves to separating those tithes. You needed a local population of Shalayim to collect and administer those tithes and take care of everything that needed to be taken care of, and those, all of that needed to be put in place. Says Nehemiah, that's really what I've accomplished. And so he says, over the course of this larger arc of Shivat Zion, of the return to Yerushalayim, to Zion, Zerubbabel did this, I did this, and the sort of the sum total of all of this, that we've been able to establish not only a rebuilt community, but one that was able to sustain itself. The book of Ezra Nehemiah is a book of the struggle, the successful struggle for survival of the nascent Jewish community that has returned to the land of Israel. It's the story of modern Zionism, but told in a different way, with its own characters and with its own nuances, but it's very much the same exact story. So I think that's one theme that we have here. And then the second piece I think that you have as well is that you have the combining of different eras. Why combine different eras? I think what you have here is the sense that Nehemiah is moving to the conclusion of his work. Nehemiah has one chapter left. So what is he doing here? He's pulling together different eras in the scope of the book of Ezra Nehemiah. The time of Zerubbabel, these were the people who made Aliyah. At the time of Ezra Nehemiah, these were the people who came to the land of Israel. At the time of Zerubbabel, here's with the tithes that were offered. At the time of Nehemiah, here's what was collected and taken care of in the Beit HaMikdash. So I think when you put it all together, when you pull it all together, I think what we have here is really the sense that we are moving toward a conclusion of the Sefer. And God willing, next week we will have the opportunity to examine the 13th and final perek, and we will see ultimately the conclusion that Nehemiah offers for his Sefer, that's God willing what we will tackle next time. Now I say next time because next week is holiday of Purim, so we will not be meeting. You enjoy your time. So we'll obviously not be meeting next week, but I believe that in 2 weeks we should be back on our regular schedule. And very much looking forward. Yeah. Strong.